I don't see Adam's name at the top.
It was. I had definitely had him in the group.
I mean, I could be missing it. Maybe it's not just not showing with the full grouping.
It does say 4-4, though. Huh. Okay. Thought I had it.
Okay, you know what? Somehow it's excluding him, and I don't understand why.
Shane, why don't you shoot Adam a quick message just saying that we're working on this, just technical problems. Thanks.
You know, would do any of you guys, or do either of you guys have the ability to reinitiate the call with all five of us in? Because for some reason it looks like this is not at all Adam's fault. It looks like somehow when I'm setting up the conversation, I'm including his name, but then when I start the conversation, it's kicking him out.
Well, let's see.
I don't know why.
I'm sorry, I'm technically, I don't know, unless I have an outdated
Skype contact for him.
Oops, now I left.
There's got to be a way to have him added in here. We've had him on before.
Is Skype imposing like a 4-person limit?
No, not that I'm aware of. And why would
I just looked at participants and it says 4 or 5 in the call and it has Adam at the bottom, not in the call.
I just clicked on it to add him. It had like a little phone next to him that I clicked on.
Ring. It says calling Adam. Let's see if that gets him in.
And I added him to the call.
Here he is.
Now watch, it'll be some other Adam.
There he is.
Hey. Okay, don't celebrate too soon. I can't hear any of you.
Oh, no.
We're going to celebrate anyway. Mm. He's a little out of focus, but he's there.
There we go.
Can you hear us, Adam?
Yes, now I can.
Yes.
All right.
The speaker's inputs had somehow reset themselves to the microphone, and the microphone cannot emit sound. It can only take it in.
Yeah.
So I needed to dangle that, but now I... Okay. So thank you for finally calling me so that we can actually, you know, talk to one another.
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined on this week's episode of Back to the Bins by one of my usual co-hosts, Dr. Bill Robinson.
I don't have a book.
Who has no book, of course. But you know what? In a pleasant change of circumstances, neither do I. And we are joined today by the artist formerly known as, and we could put some sort of glyph there, but my old friends, Adam Murdo, Chris Eberle, and Shane Mulholland. How are you guys doing?
Well,
it's a pleasure to be on again. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Ready to lose those summer blues.
You know it's always a pleasure to have you guys. I always enjoy the conversation. And you're doing all the legwork. I didn't have to bring any books with me today. Although I did read the ones that you guys brought, which is an interesting grouping, as always.
You did better than me. I only read the one that I brought. I was, as I stated earlier privately, it's been a busy week.
Playing the role of Adam this time is Shane. But I was telling the guys before you got on with this, Adam, that interestingly, your book we had done once before, not this group. I believe it was just Scott and I had done it. And for some reason, that episode has not made its way, or it has lost its way from our website and may not exist anymore. I'm going to have to try and find it. And I have no recollection of what it is exactly that I said about it. I'm sure I said that I like it, but I don't remember the details of the conversation. So, you know, much like a comic reader with dementia, this will be the first time I ever did this one.
Jeez. I love when you go dark. That was fantastic. Well done.
Well, you know, we talk about sometimes that whichever creator it was that said, you know, every book could be somebody's first. And then as I forget certain books that I've read, I could say, you know, that's the beauty of it. Every book could be my first.
I'm old.
So we're going to jump right in with this. And the book that we have done before, but is lost to the annals of time, is Astonishing Tales number 25, which is Adam's book for today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have my copy of it right here in hand. It's part of a rich vein of really good stuff that bubbled to the top of my to-be-read pile from one of the first Wild Pig comic sales I ever attended. It might even have been the first. I'm not entirely sure, but it happened right around the end of March, beginning of April 2007. The bargains that I got 50 cents for it. It's celebrated August. So this is a comic that's celebrating a golden anniversary this year, which is one reason why I picked it for review. And it's the first appearance of a new feature for this series, coming hot on the heels of the brief but storied run of It, the Living Colossus, in the pages of Astonishing Tales, Deathlok the Demolisher. The cover blurb proclaims, "Is he man or machine or monster?" Kind of echoing Incredible Hulk number one there. "You can't know till you've read our fearsome first issue, the steel-smashing origin of the world's most offbeat superhero. And down at the bottom, perhaps the greatest creation yet in the Marvel Age of Comics Phase 2.
Phase 2. So,
even back in the 70s, Marvel was thinking in terms of phases, apparently. And I'm going to throw in here a little something from the Bullpen Bulletins page within, further hyping this first appearance of the Deathlok character. Yeah, here we go. Item: this is it, the month when we present a dynamic new feature, which starts in the current issue of Astonishing Tales, now on sale. First, though, that fabled picture worth a thousand words, and then there's a little picture of Deathlok aiming his little laser pistol at the reader. Okay, now that you've taken a gander at what our newest, maybe most offbeat hero yet looks like, we'll fill you in. He's Deathlok the Demolisher, and he's part cyborg, part superhero, and maybe just a touch of monster. All rolled into one pulsating package by Rich Swashbuckler, who conceived and drew the awesome origin tale, and Devil May Care Doug Munch, who supplied some of the most unique scripting we've seen in a month of Mondays. Quite frankly, we think Deathlok's going to take the waiting world by storm, and that's no hype. Yeah, sure it isn't. Pick up Astonishing Tales number 25 and see for yourself why 1974 is already being heralded as the Marvel Age of Comics Phase 2. So there you go. They just stuck that in there a couple of times. So yes, as that little bit of non-hype informed us, the character was created a couple of years before this issue shall print, actually, by Rich Buckler. He was planning to make it the main character of a novel, but instead he ended up bringing it to comics. He was going to call it Deathlok originally, but then Doug Munch then amended that to Deathlok without the C. Conceived and drawn Buckler with assists from Glasson, Al Milne, and scripted by Doug Munch, colors by Glynis Ween, lettered by A. Kowecki, edited by Roy Thomas. The story is called A Cold Maze. The script is as complicated as advertised. As the story it tells is of what's left of a man named Colonel Luther Manning, who was a career military man, one of the most brilliant military strategists of his generation. But unfortunately, that wasn't enough to save him from a concussion mine in some kind of military exercise in the middle of a tragic world war that's going on in some dystopian future world of the 1980s. At one point in the story, we're told that the war started in 1983, which is roughly 10 years in this comic's future. This was published in 74. So Colonel Manning gets himself blown up real good, and then he falls into the tender mercies of Project Alpha Mech and one Major Simon Riker, who recreate Colonel Manning's body into a deadly military cyborg, and they plug a little piece of his brain into a sophisticated, for the time, computer. I mean, it's not so sophisticated. It doesn't need its instructions fit into it by punch card, because this is still 1974 we're talking about here. And the story kind of jumps back and forth in time between an emancipated Deathlok, who's out there trying to make a living as a mercenary to fund his hopeful eventual reconversion to some kind of a human state. He's out there killing two men for money, and then trying to collect payment for these jobs from some crime lord or other, who in the end turns out to be just like a cyborg mouthpiece being remote controlled by none other than his creator and archenemy, Major Riker. And Riker, through this cyborg mouthpiece, duped Deathlok into assassinating the two people in North America who have the best chance of exposing and stopping Project Alpha Mech from creating more Deathloks. So there's the irony. And this is all intercut with flashbacks to different points in the creation of Deathlok. And then the script, the inner monologue is really more of an inner dialogue for Deathlok. It is kind of complicated narrative captioning here from Doug Munch. There are blue caption boxes, which is the brain computer of Deathlok talking to, you know, its human half, Luther Manning. There are yellow captions, which are Manning's human and very pissed off personality, kind of quarreling with the computer. And every once in a while, you get kind of a merged, confluent subconsciousness in these little square green boxes, which is when Munch really gets kind of poetic and purple. Here's an example. As Deathlok is firing his laser pistol at one of his targets, the computer says, "Now fire." Manning thinks, "Yes, now." And then the green box, which is kind of the both of them together, says, "Feel the exquisite pleasure of our flex steel fingers vice squeezing a streaking spurt of ripping, searing, boring light."
That's the way normal people think, right?
Of course. Well, that they've got a half a computer implanted in their brain, sure, why not? And if Doug Munch is at the word processor attached to that computer. It's pretty, in the creator's own words, cinematic storytelling. That was a major part of their great creative philosophy here. You know, they themselves, there's like a little feature at the back. I don't know if you guys were able to see that reading this on Marvel Unlimited or whatever, but there was like a little text piece of Roy Thomas interviewing Buckler and Munch, and they described their own work as like cinematic. Hitchcock was listed as an influence. I'm guessing that probably a why did this person's name just fly out of my head? Kubrick was probably another, because he was kind of a hot talent back then. There's certain pages where that cinematic influence is very obvious. There's one splash page on pages 17 and 18 where you get Riker debriefing Deathlok as he's Alamex home facility, fiction style. And that's an image that's kind of referenced in the cover image here. As you can see, Deathlok kind of breaking loose from his bonds. But that splash page is an overhead shot, kind of a straight down crane shot.
Great page.
Of Deathlok hanging up there and being cross-examined by Riker and his scientists just before Deathlok breaks loose and goes on the run. This is a good example of cutting edge but also fairly depressing early to mid-70s science fiction. I mean, in tone, it reminds me a lot of Logan's Run. I mean, the subject matter is drastically different. It's not the same kind of dystopian future, but in tone, there's a definite similarity. And it's honestly not the sort of thing that I would first choose to read. I mean, I mainly chose to talk about it because, A, I'm stuck down here in Stone Harbor, and I can only discuss those comics I happen to have with me. And this is one of the ones that I do have and have recently read. And for another thing, it was just synchronicity that this thing came out 50 years ago. It'll be almost 50 years to the day, I think, but by the time this episode makes its way out to the public. I think August 10th was the actual on-stand date.
We'll be over 50 years by the time it cuts out.
And, one more thing of note I should mention here. It's also historically significant, not just because it's the first appearance of Deathlok and all of that. It's an early example of work by Doug Munch, who'd been working for Marvel for less than a year at the time this thing was published. But also, there's this little, like, two-page gag strip at the very back, which depicts satirically the creative process between Munch and Buckler, which basically consists of these two long-haired hippies telling each other, "That stinks, man." But it's here is that page, and you can see there's kind of a hole down in – well, you can't see it very well, but there is a hole down in the lower right where somebody ripped out the Marvel value stamp on the letters page.
Clip them and collect them.
Mm-hmm. And that's, Chris, that's probably why it was in the 50-cent bins at your Wild Pig sale, because it's just...
Sure it was.
But that little two-page gag strip was actually, believe it or not, the first ever published work of George Perez.
Really?
That's right. Yep. Yeah, I heard it,
that. Written by Doug Munch with art by Perez and Mike Esposito. Huh. And it, you really wouldn't know to look at it. It really looks more like the Joe Kubert artwork than it does like Perez. It's a far cry from what his work would evolve into later on. But still, fact remains, this is his first... First appearance in a Big Two comic.
I did not know that.
The little joke strip, to me at least, is a. It feels like a throwback to the days when Kirby and Lee would have a little like gag strip like that in of the two of them doing something creative. I like that aspect of it because it makes it feel like it belongs. But there's also just an element of this book where it. Screams to me of this, you know, this is phase two. Now we're going into the Bronze Age and we're going for a different feel from everything you've seen before. You know, we developed this universe in the Silver Age, and now we're going to expand it and change it and bring in new minds to look at it. So, you know, this in its own way is a breath of fresh air in a dystopian kind of way.
Murd, I want to salute you, brother, for selecting this, because I've only read this story, I think, once in my life and so long ago that I barely remembered it, and it was really refreshing to read it again, especially, you know, as a middle-aged man, because, A, I've always been a Rich Buckler fan, because, you know, he did work on Jungle Action with Black Panther, so I knew his work primarily from that. I thought that work was stunning, and I thought his artwork here was beautiful, especially the splash page that you described. And I have to admit, I normally don't like to read comics online, but I got this on Comixology, so I was going like the panel-to-panel movement that they allow you to do, mm-hmm. and this the art has such a cinematic feel that it actually worked for me reading it that way, going from panel to panel, because the art is so dynamic and so striking, especially when Deathlok is chasing his prey in the beginning of the book, and you know the guy is running, and like you said, Murd, you have mm-hmm. to get a little used to the fact that you have to. Exactly, and you have different, you have dual narration going on. You have his human side and his cyborg side, you know, kind of arguing with each other as they're going through this. But the artwork is really stunning, and Buckler was such a great. I mean, he's now deceased, unfortunately, but such a great talent. And also, as Paul said, because it's the Bronze Age, it's grittier, it's more violent. All the stuff that you really start to see in comics in the 1970s. Although I thought it was kind of funny that. One of the men he's slain, even though his whole chest was blown apart, had the time to reflect as he was dying how he felt pity for this man who had become a cyborg, which is very, very Bronze Age. I was laughing at a lot. I got a huge kick out of that. I don't know if it's Doug Monk or Doug Munch, whichever, but...
I always want to say Monk, Chris, because that's closer to how it would be pronounced in German. Like
okay.
Mink, something like that. But I believe he actually does pronounce it Munch.
Really? Because I thought I had heard that it was pronounced Monk, but I could... Totally okay. Be wrong.
Regardless, I just wanted to say that he's a favorite writer of mine. Now, a little bit later on, he's going to start writing Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu. And, I mean, his run on that, and I mean, he develops really incredibly as a writer on that title, especially as you get into the later 70s, 1980s stuff. I think one of the times he was on the show, we did a Master of Kung Fu, if I remember correctly.
You brought a great issue.
Thank you. Mm. So it was really thrilling to see some of his earliest work. In fact, Murders remind me that I remember reading an interview in Tomorrow's about the Bronze Age of Marvel, and Munch was recounting how his hair was so long that he could sit on it.
Jeez.
And he said he had to get like a loan from a bank, and he asked Stan Lee to be like his not like his co-signer, but like vouch for him. So Stan Lee wrote like this snazzy like recommendation letter for him, and it was just fun to read that, but. This is a great selection. It's great to see two wonderful creators, sort of like we're at the very beginning of their career. But I think even then, Buckler had the stuff. Like the art is really impressive. I think in this,
I almost feel bad that you read it on Marvel Unlimited, even though you found a plus on that, just because Buckler did such an atypical version of putting these panels together and the grids that he did. Yeah. That it feels very, very elegant in the way that he tells the story. And I feel like you'd lose that going panel by panel, even though you did get more out of it for doing that.
Yeah, I just, you know, Pal, it's funny. I find that when I try to, I normally don't like to read comics online, sort of in general, but for shows like this, obviously I will, happily, but I don't like reading the comics just when they just have the pages. Part of that's because my eyesight's starting to go, and it's hard for me to read them like that on a computer. But the panel by panel, it's actually easier for me because I'm just getting older.
I wanted to ask, does anybody know if Deathlok's even used anymore in Marvel? I haven't heard of him in a long time.
Murd probably has more background on that than I do.
Well, as far as stuff that's being done with him recently, I mean, I'm a little behind, you know.
Well, that's right, yes. So he was reintroduced in the 90s. They had like a relaunch, and he's been different people, I think, each time. Mm-hmm. He's been brought back. Funny thing, when I first read this was in 1983.
Huh.
So I'm like, my God, there's supposed to be a war happening now? I mean, Ronald Reagan is president, but...
Yeah, I think a version of Deathlok turned up in the Avengers Forever ongoing series from just a couple of years ago, which was like a multiversal...
I just picked that up. I haven't read it, but yeah, he was on one of the covers, and I'm kind of curious whenever I get around to reading that to see what that's all about.
Okay. And to add to that, wasn't Deathlok... He was an early African-American character, was he not?
Yes. Right? Luther Manning was. The later one, I think, is not.
Okay. I seem to remember the later one being in the Fantastic Four at one point. Not part of the Fantastic Four, but guest starring in the series. And right, yeah. I think he was an African-American man also.
Yeah. The 90s the other names. Michael Collins was black. Okay. Yes. And also, it was the Dwayne McDuffie run on Fantastic Four you're referring to.
And also, maybe people are more current in multimedia. Deathlok appeared in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
That's right.
That was as they were just starting to embrace the, we can show the people the way they are in the comics and we don't have to dumb it down or make it seem more real. They were building towards what they do now, I thought. From an interesting, to me, interesting perspective on this is, you know, the whole Rich Buckler aspect. First of all, you know, as much as Doug Monk might have added to it, I think this truly was Buckler's baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some interactions before he passed, may he rest in peace, at New York Comic Con and different shows. I had run into Rich a couple of times, and I have
he was at the show by your house, the small one.
Yes, the Eternal Con.
Eternal Con.
Yeah. And we had some conversations about different things, and yeah, I always found him to be very welcoming and just a pleasure to talk to, besides the fact that he was a great talent. And I was mostly familiar with him in this era from his work on the Fantastic Four, when he fell under a lot of criticism, and I think wrongly so, they'd say, oh, he stole some positions or whatever in books. But I think in the Fantastic Four in particular, he was asked to do it as much like Kirby as he could. And I thought he'd do a lot of that.
That was a common refrain for many artists in that time period.
Yeah.
Stanley urged that.
And I thought he did a tremendous job of it, and then he got criticized for it. So that's just a sensitive point as far as I'm concerned, because I don't like the criticism he received there. But anyway, he was talking about Jungle Action at one point, which you mentioned, and somehow the name Klaus Janson came up, and I hadn't realized that he worked with Klaus Janson. And he said, oh, yeah, in Jungle Action, whatever, you know, and I was like, oh, and I sorted it out, and I kind of looked at it again. I was like, okay, this is what Rich Buckler, who has a very clean style, looks like when combined with Klaus Janson, who is much more muddy in his style. And I found that to be an interesting thing. And then when I'm looking at this, the interesting thing is the only thing Janson did is the cover, which I find to be very, very clean. And then the inside of it looks more to me like it's got that Janson touch to it because of the dystopian look about it, even though Janson didn't do the inside. So I just found that really interesting as I was reading it. I love the artwork in this book. I think this is just really, like I said, I think this was a labor of love for him. I think he really put everything he had into this, and it shows as far as I'm concerned.
Mur, do you know how long Deathlok ran in that title? I don't recall.
I can tell I'm afraid you I don't, Chris.
I was just curious. In the 70s, Marvel did this with a lot of new characters. They put them in one of their house titles for a period of time.
He continued in Astonishing Tales until it ended, which was in issue 35. I think there were two issues of Marvel Spotlight that continued his story, if I remember correctly, which I may or may not.
Ace Production, thank you.
Didn't Rich Buckler... I could be getting this character confused with another like him, but I thought Rich Buckler, like in Fantastic Four in the 190s, wasn't there a character that Dr. Doom had created, or like a person that he had caused to be a cyborg, and he was kind of like in purple, but he had mechanical features to him?
He was actually introduced in issue like 138, somewhere around there.
Was that a Rich Buckler?
That was back when Buckler was doing it.
Okay, all right. Because I thought, looking at this, I was like, it was reminiscent of something else as well.
And then the story turned out that he was an old Air Force buddy of Ben Grimm's who was in a crash, and then they...
The name Desmond Pitts.
Yeah. The character of I can't even think of the villainous army guy... reminds me of Thunderbolt Ross in his appearance and his mannerisms.
Yep, good call.
Yeah, good call. Definitely. Oh, yeah. And how about that wannabe EC Comics twist ending?
Yes. But you know what? Part of what I look at when we do books on the show, especially when we're doing one issue, and especially if it's the first issue of a storyline, one of the things that I go with is, does it make me want to read the next issue? And I think that little twist ending makes you say, ooh, I want to see where this goes.
I agree wholeheartedly. Yep. So, great pick, Mert.
Do we want to rate this, or does anybody have any more comments on it? Okay, I guess we'll rate it. Adam, it's your book, so we usually let you go first. If you remember, it's cover, story, art, and then the whole book on a whole.
Full package. Okay. Well, the cover is certainly iconic enough. So I'll give that an A. The story, like I said, it's not my normal cup of tea. It's depressing mid-70s science fiction, but it's dripping with thematic concerns at the time, all these fears of automation, computerization, mechanization, the military-industrial complex creeping into our lives. Yeah, and it's dramatic and cinematic, and it's telling, and Doug Monk, I mean, he goes a little purple with the dialogue sometimes. I mean, he later lamented that it took him twice as long to script Deathlok than it did anything else he was working on at the time. But, the extra effort shows. I think even though I personally don't really enjoy this kind of science fiction that much, it's a well enough done example of it that I'll give that an A as well. Artwork, I've been a fan of Rich Buckler's stuff as well, although I tend to prefer, when he works on like cleaner Golden Age concepts. But even so, I give him credit for being experimental. There was that great little overhead crane shot thing that we've been talking about. I'll give that an A as well. So overall package, I guess it all has to average out to an A.
Well, I always say it is whatever you decide it is. Some of the parts doesn't have to, the total does not have to equal the sum of the parts. It's whatever you say.
Okay, then I give it an A- overall.
Okay, it's fair enough.
Because many of my A's were given grudgingly and only in an attempt to give the benefit of the doubt to a guy that I think was well made, but that I didn't like all that much, if you know what I'm saying.
You know, that's a factor. That's something that you have to factor in, is in total enjoyment. I'm gonna be a little different from you because I did enjoy this. I thought this was a groundbreaking issue as far as I was concerned. I think the cover is really good, and I give it an A. I think the interior art is even better, so I'm giving that an A+. I really like the interior art in this. I don't think there's one page that I feel I wouldn't love to own the original art if I had an opportunity, and that has nothing to do with resale value. I'm just talking about for enjoyment of owning it. I think it's just wonderful. The story is, I think the story is really good. I do think the scripting is a little heavy-handed at points. I think the dialogue is possibly just a victim of trying too hard. So even though I think the overall story is really top-notch, I'm going to give it a B+ on the story itself. And overall, I'm going to give the book an A. Anybody want to go next?
Yeah.
All right, Paul.
So, you know what? I'm just going to give – I'm not going to add to anything that anyone has brought up. But so it's an A book overall, but I'm going to give it an A+. And you know why? Because I totally forgot that at the bottom of the pages back then, they used to have little blurbs to make you buy other books. Yep. Don't be lazy. Buy Crazy, the humor mag that dares to be dumb.
Dares to be dumb.
And I had totally forgot about those until just looking at this tonight. And I was like, oh, wow. So A+. Plus for the blurbs.
Shane, you didn't read this one, correct?
No.
Okay. Paul, my scores are very similar to yours. Covers an A, art's an A. I agree with the story. I mean, I love Monk as a writer, but I think his greatness is still to come, essentially, over the next couple of years. So I'll give the story a B+ and an A- for the whole package. Really important book. Great pick by Murd.
Yeah, no, terrific pick. I hope what I said about this today mirrors what I said the last time, because I don't know.
You'll find that last one, and they'll be like, man, this was really weird.
There'll be some listener out there who will actually remember and say, no, you didn't give it an A+, you gave it a B-.
Paul, it's a mark of wisdom and maturity that you can change your mind.
Yeah. There you go. I'll take that as an excuse, if nothing else. okay, so then we'll move on to the DC, which is Batman number 451.
So that was my pick, and it is cover date July 1990, which means it came out in May of 1990, written by Marv Wolfman, penciled by Jim Aparo, inked by Mike DiCarlo, colors was Adrian Rory, letters were John Costanza, edited by Denny O'Neill and Dan Raspler, cover artist Norm Breyfogle and Anthony Tolan. Number 451 is sort of the second part to 450, but I'm actually going to go back to Batman 429 first, the last chapter of the death of A Death in the Family, because if I remember right, and what I kind of researched a little bit this week about, at the end of Death in the Family, the Joker's on a helicopter trying to get away. Batman's trying to stop him from everything that happened in Death in the Family. And seemingly the Joker dies. The helicopter blows up and everybody thinks the Joker's dead. And I believe that 450 and 451 are the first times he is back in the DC universe since A Death in the Family, which is almost, almost 2 years, pretty close to it. So it's a pretty good span of time when there was no Joker in DC at all, if I'm remembering right. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But the reason I picked the book was I was going through the Batman gallery, kind of scrolling through it in the DC app, and I was looking for something that I knew I had read in my heyday of getting Batman, and I stumbled upon that cover, which I think is absolutely gorgeous for a Joker cover. And then I realized it was 1990, which was not only the year I graduated high school, it was a month and a half or so before my 18th birthday. And I thought it would be a little bit ironic to just go back to that time of just on the cusp of being adult, knowing that I was reading Batman like crazy. It was one of the few regular books I was getting at that time, because in 1990, I was still kind of in my infancy of comic book collecting. I mean, I had gotten Justice League and some other things, but really G.I. Joe and Justice League were my gateway into books with Spider-Man and then Batman. And really all of that started like 1985, 86 for the most part. So this is still within the first 5-6 years of me collecting and reading it all. But I was a huge Batman fan. So this was a book that I got every single month without question. I also kind of picked this because I miss what I would consider a good old-fashioned Joker story, a good old-fashioned Joker design. Some of the stories that come out today might be enjoyable and they're interesting, but sometimes I think they're a little bit too weird, too grotesque. When you take what more recently was the Joker cutting his face off and plastering it back on, kind of. I read it and I enjoyed it. But I miss old school Joker stories and old school Riddler stories and old school Batman stories. And now I really sound like a get off my lawn kind of man because I'm nostalgically talking about what I miss about things today. So this story, this part of the story opens up with you have someone impersonating the Joker and kind of freaking Commissioner Gordon out and Batman to a certain extent, not only because of what happened in A Death in the Family, again, going with this being the first time they've seen Joker in a while, but if I'm not mistaken, the other kind of significant part about 450 and 451, it also brings into the DCU proper everything that happened in The Killing Joke, where it's recognized in the main DC universe that Barbara Gordon was shot and paralyzed by the Joker, and really brings Alan Moore's story into the fold, much to, I believe, his chagrin, which I don't think he wanted. It was just meant to be a standalone story. But if I'm right, that's everything that's surrounding this book. So in a lot of ways, it was an interesting nexus of not only things that were happening at that time, but my own memory of it. So you follow not only the real Joker coming in and trying to figure out who the fake Joker is and do away with him because he can't stand anybody impersonating him. He's still recovering from what happened to him in the helicopter crash. You have Batman freaking out because he thought the Joker was dead and still quite upset about everything that happened to Jason Todd. You have Commissioner Gordon, who also is reeling from what happened to his daughter, Barbara. At one point, he goes to the library to see Barbara, and she's, of course, in a wheelchair, and he tells her that the Joker might still be around, and is she okay? And she's being very strong and everything, but he's very much worried and concerned. And the story progresses to solving who the fake Joker is and him kind of dying in a similar fashion to how the real Joker was created by falling into the vat of chemicals at Ace Chemical Factory. But Batman at one point remarks about how, or maybe it's Gordon, one of them remarks about, no, don't just fall into there because the chemicals are so much more potent now. It won't do to you what it did to the original Joker. You'll just die, which he does. And then the story kind of wraps up with the Joker escaping, as he always does, because Commissioner Gordon couldn't bring himself to shoot the Joker when he thought he was going to do that and had the chance. Something distracted him. Batman's trying to protect Gordon. He's a little bit frail in this issue, and he's uniquely something that doesn't happen anymore to either smoking in it and talking about how he has to quit, which I think also leads to later stories about his health for Commissioner Gordon. So it was just a very interesting story. The artwork I thought was gorgeous. Again, for me, good old-fashioned mid to late 80s. I know it's 1990, but good old-fashioned what I consider DC art, what I remember very fondly of that time period. And it just took me back to being a high school kid enjoying Batman stories with some classic villains that I adored at that time and still do. But they're just written so differently today that I really enjoyed really going back to the bins to read this one.
I thought I had never read this. So I'm going to start off by saying thank you for getting me to read something I hadn't. And it really got me thinking as I was reading it because I just enjoyed the comparison of what was going on in everybody's minds. You know, what Commissioner mm-hmm. Gordon was going through, what Batman was going through, what the Joker was going through. There are very few stories that I feel give you a humanizing element of the Joker without diminishing him. And I kind of feel like we got that in this story. Yes, he's showing his PTSD and, you know, his weakness in his own way. But that weakness is something that he's overcoming. So it's not like in the long run this is going to be a negative thing, but it's still giving you a peek behind the armor a little bit without showing you too much. And I really like that. And then on top of that, I grew up with Jim Aparo drawing Batman. And usually by the time we get to this era, when I look at the books, it is a somewhat diminished Jim Aparo. He's not what he was, you know, 15 years earlier. And yet it feels like this story, I don't know if it invigorated him or what it did, but this looks like better Jim Aparo art for this era than I'm used to.
Okay.
So I really enjoyed this. Go ahead, Chris.
Shane, one of the many reasons I love you is whenever you bring up a book you love, you always make it autobiographical. And I love how you weave it into your own life at the time. I love this guy, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Second, like Paul, I've never read this book. Now, as a retailer, I know this cover so well because I had it in my store so many times.
It's a great cover.
And I didn't realize Marv Wolfman wrote this. And when I saw Marv wrote it, I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to love this. And I was not disappointed. Like Paul said, that the different perspectives, just how each character is viewing the situation, and also the way Wolfman took you into the mind of the Joker. And now he's struggling with the fact that his identity, as he sees, has been compromised by the charlatan who has taken his place. It was really fun to read. And also, you know, the reckoning with the impact of Gordon smoking on his body, what I thought was really interesting, because you rarely see him. He's always got the pipe or something, but they really – Miller addressed it in Dark Knight Returns, but that's in the future. But so that was really interesting to see. And again, like Paul said, I love Jim Aparo's art. It was great to see it in this book. Those clean lines, everything about it was so classic DC from this era. This is a winner, Shane. I really enjoyed this. I mean, again, it's Wolfman, so the scripting is very sophisticated. You really get a sense of each character's place at that time. Batman haunted by the loss of Jason Todd. Excellent selection. Just top flight Batman.
You know, someone,
well, you dropped me down a memory hole, Shane.
Yeah.
Because in 89, when the movie came out, I was in the service, and my roommate at the time, he fell in love with Batman. So I was like, oh, well, here, let me show you this Batman comic. And then he proceeded to just, you know, he's like, oh, Jim Aparo, oh, my God. And he was buying them, and Norm Breyfogle for the covers. And I knew him for a few years after that, and he just stayed a Batman fan because of this era, this, you know, a little bit before this, and then after this, he just fell in love with it.
That's very cool. Even going through this a little bit and looking at all the covers to just try and decide on picking one. Now, a few years ago, I can't remember the exact year, but most of this Batman collection that I had, because I had from probably 350 up to current at that time, every issue. And I think I sold them all to Chris for one of the Wild Peak sales.
You did indeed, sir.
But going through all these covers and looking at this, I'm like, boy, oh boy, I'm going to have to make a short list and just try to reclaim a few issues of this, because some of this is just so good. And this issue is just one that has always stood out in my mind.
Another great moment in the book, Shane, that I really enjoyed, and I always love when they do this, is when when Bruce and Alfred have their heart-to-hearts.
Oh, yeah.
And Bruce just asked flat out, like, you know, he says, you know, Alfred, am I crazy? And Alfred gives typical witnesses like, well, I'm not really going to answer that. But but I love when they explore that dynamic, because Alfred, you always know that Alfred, while he's loyal to Bruce, he doesn't approve really of what he's doing to himself and to his life.
Yeah.
So that's great touch.
I also like that Alfred knows Bruce better than Bruce knows Bruce.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Alfred is the one who tells him that you're not a killer, because he's struggling with the idea of, why didn't I kill him? But Alfred already knows why he didn't kill him. So I like that. Go ahead.
That's, again, I apologize, Paul.
No, don't apologize.
That's one of the great debates, I think, among Batman readers is, you know, if you kill the Joker, a lot of people would then be alive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, taking out the cynical, well, he's a great villain. You need him in the stories for sales, but embedding in the story, Batman, you know, except when he had guns way back in the beginning of the Golden Age, and he definitely killed people, often very violently. But, you know, the modern Batman doesn't do that, and you get great drama out of that. And obviously that's never more present than when he's dealing with the Joker. So just a great issue.
And it's something to talk about, that dynamic between Alfred and Bruce. And something that I think that they did, one of the greatest things they did really well in Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, was Michael Caine's portrayal of Alfred in feeling that same way, not really approving of what Bruce did all the time, but kind of when it got to a certain point in those movies, Alfred actually left, which I don't know that really happened much in the comic. And I thought in reading this issue, that showed what kind of detail they put in those movies even. To give Alfred that kind of character, that he really didn't want to support Bruce to hurt himself anymore, and he thought by now he would be satisfied and done, and if he's going to do it, then Alfred, he's not staying around any longer. So just always an interesting dynamic, and really, you know, for my sappiness, always a great father-son story, no matter when it's brought up, as much as Alfred's the consummate butler. He still is, for all intents and purposes, and we all know this. He's Alfred's father. He's the guy who cares for him the most, brought him up, and wants better for him than what he's doing.
And one of the interesting things is, on the cinematic level or the television level, I've never seen a portrayal of Alfred that I didn't like.
Yeah.
Which is more than I can say for a lot of characters who've been around in multiple iterations.
Yeah.
Well, it's such a rich character, and there's so many facets to Alfred. You know, his background as, I think, a soldier.
Oh, yes. Honor Majesty's Secret Service, even.
Yeah, and he has, you know, medical training, and, you know, he's seen a lot in his life. And to go back to Shane's point, in the second Nolan film, when he tells Bruce the story about when he was serving, I guess, as a mercenary or something in Asia somewhere, and he talks about the band that he was hunting, like they were really tapping into that kind of obliquely, that part of Alfred's life. I really love that scene.
Yeah.
Plus Michael Caine, he's just great in everything. Oh, Michael Caine even makes Jaws 4 better. I mean, you know,
Michael Caine is one of the actors who I can say he's been in a bad movie, but he's never been bad in a movie.
He's well put. Oh, he's been in a ton of bad movies, Paul.
Yes.
That guy always worked. Oh my God.
But Adam, as the group historian, is there a relationship or a story about the relationship between Alfred and Thomas Wayne and why they had loyalty to each other?
Hmm. Not that I can recall reading.
Okay. So I think that, you know, sometimes it's almost bad if they explore things too much and they give you too much history. On the other hand, it feels like it would be ripe to tell a story of, you know, them meeting in, you know, in the military or something where you know, they have a life debt to each other or something like that.
Well, I don't know if that's ever been done. I don't know off the top of my head either, but I mean, they certainly allude to it many times in many different media formats. Now, that Alfred show that was on recently where he's young Alfred, which I didn't see. Do they go into that relationship or no?
I have not watched it yet.
Okay.
Neither have I.
Yeah, that's a blank spot for this group.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, sometimes the stories are better left untold and just kind of leave it to you to kind of think to yourself. Now, that's hard to do when you have thousands of issues with a character. It's hard to have an idea and say, well, I'm going to just leave that one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get the mixed feeling of you picked a really good book, but it still feels like you almost picked it at random.
Sort of, yeah. I was going through and just picking, that cover. I remember that cover. I remember reading it. And then as I opened it and flipped through it before I decided, I'm like, yep, this is going to be the book because of everything that happens in here, which was totally random. I first was drawn to remembering how much I loved that cover. And then the richness inside was sort of coincidental.
Now, the only thing that as I was reading it, I kind of just rolled my eyes a little bit, and it's a normal pet peeve I have, is the ability of characters in comics to put on a mask and have people not know he's wearing a mask.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially with the Joker's somewhat abnormal shaped face, that you could just put on a Joker mask and, oh, no, that's him, that's the Joker. Now, I'll accept it, you know, I got a headcanon it a little bit that people are so terrified of the Joker that they glance at him and then they look away, so they're not looking closely enough to see that it's a mask. You know, we recently did a story where we, you know, we covered a two-part story from the Golden Age, which introduced the character of Two-Face. And it's yet another one where Batman has, at one point in the story, has a mask on over his cowl, and people don't know.
Fantastic.
Well, and I also was thinking about not only exactly what you thought, Paul, with people would be terrified and just look away, but also thinking that most people probably die and don't get to say what the Joker really looks like.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm. So, we ready to put some grades on this one?
Sure.
All right, so cover, I think, is an A. Inside art's an A. The story, for me, is an A easily. I really give the whole shebang an A for this. And like you alluded to, Paul, very much kind of picked at random, but I'm so glad I did. When I did a little bit of research on it, I was so flooded with, oh my God, that's right. That was what this infused into the DC universe, and that's what this brought into. So for me, in my memory and my history, this has a lot of importance to it, and I didn't even realize it when I picked it, but I'm glad I got to revisit it.
As am I. A lot of the covers from this era, which have that poster feel to them, lose me a little bit, just because I like them to have more of a nexus to the story. I mean, we don't have any point here in the story where the Joker is shooting at bats.
Yeah.
But yeah, just the same, it's so dynamic and it's so cool looking. And the fact that I looked at it like for quite a while before I even realized that Batman is behind him, descending on him. There's so much about it. There's like depth to it. So it's a solid A. I'm tempted to say A+ on the cover. It's really just excellent. The interior art, like I said, it feels like a rejuvenated Jim Aparo, and I love Jim Aparo, so I'm giving that an A. And the story, I just thought the story had so many levels to it. It had so much going for it that I'm going to say an A+ on the story. And overall, I'm going to invoke my sum of the parts thing, and I'm going to say an A+ on the whole book.
Excellent.
Go ahead, Bill.
I would just like to point out on the cover that no bats were harmed in the drawing of this cover, even though one does have two bullet holes through its wing. This is a poster-like quality, and I, too, at first did not notice that Batman was even on this cover until I was like, what are those big blue? Oh, my God, those are his hands. Oh, Batman is back there. Bray Fogel. Mm. So I'm going to give the cover an A+. The interior art, yeah, this is Jim Aparo of old. A+ as well. The story. Because it kind of does bring it into bring the Killing Joke into the DC proper, and not as like an Elseworlds tale or something else. So I'm going to give it an A as well, and I'll give it a J for Joker as my overall score.
Bird, did you read this one or no, brother?
I did read it, but it was no joke 30 years ago.
Do you have enough memory of it to read?
Early 90s. Well, Matt had it in his collection, and I have it in my collection. But unfortunately, it's back in Pennsylvania. If I'd been there, I would have dug it out and went along. And it's probably not fair for me to letter grade a comic based on like a 30-year out-of-date recollection of it. But I do definitely remember issues 450 and 51. I remember reading them. I remember this is probably issue 450, actually. The Joker sitting there in his darkened room watching TV news reports of the Joker 2's exploits and just criticizing them. No, that's not funny. That's just ironic. That's bad jokes are killing the Joker. And then that And that's what re-energizes him to get back out there and reclaim his role. And of course, the climactic scene at the Ace Chemical Works when Joker 2 thinks he's going to repeat the original Joker's origin. And there's this wonderful, grotesque irony in what happens to him after that. And also a little maybe commentary on Wolfman's part, telling us that we can't go home again. You know, all the magic of a more innocent time of comic storytelling has gone out of it. We can't get away with just having a character jump into a vat of chemicals and gain powers anymore. And so he just has what has he makes happen to Joker 2 what would probably happen to a real person if he were foolhardy enough to jump into a vat of chemicals. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And that's pretty elegant in its simplicity and its grossness.
I want to point out to the audience that Merge 30-year recollection.
Yes, as I remember it, it was an 8.
For me, it's an A all across the board.
Either that or I'm really good at faking it.
Okay. Yeah, A's across the board. Wonderful.
Okay, so for our final
Wait, before we move on, I can't let this joke go because Joker 2 was said so many times. Joker 2, Electric Boogaloo. All right, it's out of my system. Okay.
It's out of my system, too. So for our third book, I was introduced to a story I had zero familiarity with, which is... I guess Chris goes back and forth between introducing me to brand new concepts and bringing me home to stuff that I have known for 30 and 40 and 50 years. But we got a new one here this time, and I appreciate that. And Chris, why don't you tell them what you got?
Wait, okay. You didn't know who Baron Fell was?
Paul? I did not, no.
Oh.
I don't even know who that is either.
He's the ultimate ace of the Empire. He's like the Wedge Antilles. Well, I won't step on Chris's...
No toes being stepped on, sir, please. It's only comics. I appreciate it. Yeah. Shane, it's saying something when a Star Wars ace like you is not familiar with this character.
Yeah, so, I might... If I read this back in the day, I might pick up on it, but I don't remember it.
Later, his son will go on to great things in the books, which don't matter anymore.
Right, that's true. Mm-hmm. So this is... So I selected probably... one of my favorite Star Wars comics of all time. Out of all the various... Granted, I haven't read all the Star Wars comics. I've read a good cross-section of them over the years. So this is when Dark Horse was doing their very impressive run on the license for 20 years, something like that, I want to say.
Yeah, easily.
And this is from 1997. It's the Star Wars X-Wing Rogue Squadron series. This is issue 25. It's a 48-page special. Thanks to all of you for putting up with me and reading that amount of pages. Well, I think it moves briskly. It's entitled The Making of Baron Fell. The writer is Michael Stackpole, who I want to say wrote novels?
Yes, he did. Got him to sign one at a con recently. Did he write I, Jedi, or is that Aaron Alston?
I don't know. Remember.
Yeah. He did do various Star Wars books.
That's what I thought. Thank you. Pencils by Steve Crespo, inks Chip Wallace and Gary Martin, Dave Mistel colors, Vicki Williams lettering. Cover art is Timothy Bradshaw. Some listeners will know from his great Preacher covers. So that's also a treat. And cover colors by Grant Golish. Now, I'll quickly summarize. I don't want to give away the whole story because I want people who – if you're a Star Wars fan, even if you're not, this is an excellent book. And it's a great one-and-done type story. So I would encourage people to read it. All I'll say is that Baron Fell, as Bill just pointed out, is the greatest fighter pilot in the Imperial Navy. You're led to believe he's comparable to Vader, essentially. And the story is about – it opens with him – you assume in the previous issues he's been captured by the Alliance. And I know from context that in other issues I've read, the story takes place after Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
So the Empire is in decline. And he's been captured, and he's basically telling the story of his life to an off-panel interrogator. And it he's from Corellia, and it takes you through, you know, why he joins the Navy, his experiences in training, how he realizes his basically almost supernatural abilities as a pilot, and basically how he rises to the ranks in the Navy and the various intrigue and politics and familiar battles he gets involved in. Because, again, the best Dark Horse comics effortlessly weave in the movie context. So there's references in this book to various characters, events that we all know from the original trilogy. And as Bill pointed out, this book also relies heavily on a lot of the books that were coming out at that time that were expanding the Star Wars universe. So it's bringing in a lot of those elements as well. So if you've read like Zahn stuff, there's a reference to the end. I forgot the name of the character, but the big crime syndicate that was active in the galaxy at that time. I forgot the name of the character.
The Hutts or the green guy, Prince Zizor.
That's him, Zizor. They show him near the end. So yeah. Anyone
of the Empire.
Yeah, anyone who was really immersed in all that additional print media, you really should read this comic because they effortlessly weave all of it into this story combined with the original trilogy. Now, I don't want to give away the ending or the really interesting revelation about his wife, which is one of the cruxes of the whole story and essentially why he isn't going to do what he does. But two things I really love about this book. One, I think the art has a very – it's not amazing, but it has this very – this sort of this – how do I put it?
Workmanlike or like
– that it's got like a streamlined quality I think works with Star Wars, with the ships, with the technology. Also give Crespo credit because he can actually draw Darth Vader's helmet, which some artists really can't do effectively, and he's able to do that. You see Thrawn in here. He plays a key role in the story as well. But what I think is most engaging about this is that when we watch the original movies, all we know is the Empire is evil. It's not really explained to us, you know, almost like why is it there? Why are so many people loyal to it? You know, what is its purpose besides, you know, blowing up planets and being evil and conquering things? And what I like about this story is that there's a sense of nuance and that through the character of Fel, we begin to understand why many people see the Empire as a good thing and why they would feel loyalty to it. And I think what's important about this story is that it explores how perspectives can change and based on what is going on in your life. So based on what happens to Fel in his young life and where he's going, he sees the Empire as a force of good, as a force of order in the universe that maintains order, that brings stability, that protects people, essentially. He sees the rebellion as a threat to that stability and that order. In other words, he thinks he's doing the right thing. And I think especially, not to go into tangents, but especially if we look at our country today, I think it's fair to say people are living in very different realities when it comes to the state of our nation right now. And I think the story is a good reminder of, you know, to many of us as fans of this world, the Empire is evil. The Emperor is horrific. Vader's a mass murderer. You know, go down the list. But if you're living in your own little piece of that world and you're like on an agricultural world as Fel was in the beginning when he's a young man, and then you're serving as a pilot and you're having all these experiences – to him, the Empire has brought out the best in him. The Empire has given him a career that he does what he does best, which is fly. He feels that he's doing the right thing. This is a really smart, extremely well-written story. And it challenges you because it's more than just, well, the Manchian good and evil. Because real life, of course, we all know, is far more complicated than that. And that's part of the charm of the Star Wars movies, of course. But this book and a lot of the other multimedia attached to this world, obviously they dig deeper because, you know, they have to if they want to make it interesting. And you get all the fun of Star Wars. You see a lot of great space fights. You see characters you're familiar with. They even make quick mentions to, like, Biggs and Han Solo and other characters like that. But at its core, though, it's a book about someone who thinks who is clearly not a good person. And he thinks he's in the service of something that's good, but as we know, as we pull back, and as he himself begins to realize the story continues, he's not in the service of something good. And that then affects what he starts to do. Some great comics right here for me.
Yeah, it's nice when a science fiction story can lead you to something without beating you over the head with it.
Yep. Well put. So
I found initially when I picked this up, I thought it was going to be a little bit of a... I thought there was going to be a little bit of a gatekeeping feel to it where I don't know these characters. I don't know where they're going to go. It's going to be a little bit too much work to get into it, but it did not take long for me to become comfortable reading it. So, you know, kudos to it for that. I think that I'm not familiar with Stagpole or Crespo, to be fair. Crespo seems to me to be playing with almost two different styles of art here. And one of them I enjoy, and one of them I don't think is bad, but it doesn't sit with me as well. When he's doing the true Star Wars stuff, when he's doing the space battles, when he's showing Darth Vader, when he's showing the military things going on, there is a cleanness but a darkness to what he's drawing for the most part. When he's showing Fel's private life on his planet, the art style feels different to me. It almost feels like we could be reading a comic book version of Beauty and the Beast. You know, I guess it could be in Fables or something like that. And it's well drawn, but it felt like it took me out of the story a little bit because of that. So it's a criticism, but it's a criticism based on taste as opposed to, oh, this is badly done, or even to say it's a bad choice would be wrong, because it really depends on each person and how you view it. The story, I thought, quite frankly, Chris, I thought you did an even better job of encapsulating it than I was able to as I was reading it. I think your description of what went on is even a little bit more thought-provoking than what I got out of it reading it, so I'm giving you credit for pointing that stuff out to me. Initially, the very first shot on the opening page, he reminded me of Frank Castle as the Punisher. Just, you know, it's just what I saw there. But I thought it was very well done. And unlike what you just said, I thought the ending made you want to see more. It didn't feel fully encapsulated here. It felt like, okay, now where is he going to go? He's now indicating that that's he's true, willing yeah. to turn. So if he turns, where are we going with him?
You have to get X-Wing Rogue Squadron 26.
Yeah, apparently.
They do continue with this story. So
I did some quick checking because I knew Stackpole had done more, and he did at least five of the, I think, 10 or 12 Rogue Squadron series of X-Wing books.
Oh, wow.
And he also did iJedi, which was a standalone hardcover, which was had the character of Corran Horn, who is in the beginning of this book as we'll just say police officer or detective that is on Corellia, that he goes to talk to the guy about he's going to, you know, and that's how, hey, look, I got an appointment to the academy, so I can't, well, now you can't testify against this guy. So, yeah, so he actually got his career started because they wanted to get him out of the way. So, yeah, most of all the characters that are mentioned are referenced in the Rogue Squadron books. Chouyu and some of the other people all through this book. I was like, oh, I recognize that name. I recognize that. So, yeah, this was a nice little backstory. Some things that I didn't know about the character or had forgotten. Because, hey, it's nice getting old sometimes. Everything is new again.
An interesting thought. For me, you know, you mentioned how it interrelates with other characters. It references them and all of that. And sometimes I'm thinking of like when I've read Peter David Star Trek books. And when you read those books, I find them very entertaining. But every character meets every other character from every episode of the series, which makes the world feel incredibly small. And you know, it's I remember reading one where, you know, there was Q was in it and Trelane was in it and
Q-squared.
But then there was also good. What's her name, the girl with the whales from Star Trek 4, and there was like many different characters that all interrelated into the story that it just felt like, really, you know, that just seems like far too much of a coincidence. In this, I thought they did a nice job of referring to things, but not necessarily having him in the middle of it. And you know, a lot of the things that are being referred to, of course, they'd be common knowledge there. They were major, major events in that universe, but he wasn't in the middle of it, you know, which is the opposite of, say, you know, if you want to read Tegg and Bink, where they just stumble over every little scene from the movies. But you know, I just, my whole point is I thought it was well done the way that they weave him into the universe without having him all of a sudden become a key player in every event.
Well, that's a great point, Paul, and it's a reminder that, you know, the Star Wars universe and this conflict is vast. The Empire is vast. I mean, if you read, like, go to the additional films or books, I mean, there's still parts of the Empire still lingering long after the death of Palpatine and
sure.
And Vader. So I couldn't agree more that they did. Like, for example, it's good they don't show you Luke or Leia. You see Han quickly as a cadet in one panel, for example. But it's a great point on your part, and I think it's another reason why this is such a strong story.
Well, that's something I didn't do well, is I never read any of the Rogue Squadron novels nor this comic at all. I know I didn't. But through the discussion and just looking at it on the Marvel app, I tagged it so I could read it afterward. I had no idea that there was so much of things that I was reading from the early part of the newer novels infused in this. I would have never guessed Thrawn to be in this in any way. It's very interesting.
Shane, I think you're going to get a big kick out of it.
So. Yeah, the Rogue Squadron books, a lot of it is like I don't want to say behind the scenes, or like battles that, like, the retaking of Coruscant is one of the big things that takes place in those novels, and how they infiltrate and take the planet back, and then some other revelations that I won't spoil that are really jaw-dropping when they happen. I don't know if anybody else on here has read those. Anybody?
I'm not.
Okay. Well, then I'll be quiet. You ever read it? You read it. I only had one problem with the art. Just wonder if anybody else can guess. When we get the one shot of the Emperor, I can't tell if that's the Emperor, Kermit the Frog, what that is. I'm just like, okay.
Is that when they're being decorated?
Yes, long may they serve. And there's a shot of the Emperor, and I'm like, shh. Ooh.
I mean, I knew it was the Emperor right away.
Yeah, but I was just like, okay.
He almost...
A little under the weather?
He almost looks like the...
yes.
He almost looks like the Ray Park version of the Toad in the first X-Men movie.
Or I'm waiting for him, you know, the Emperor to go, mana. That's the only picture that really took me out. Everything else is beautiful, and like even like the one space battle where there's, you know, there's actually bodies floating around.
Yep, it's well done.
Yeah.
Well, I also love to piggyback on what Bill just said, is that, you know, it explores life in the Imperial Navy and the pilots and what they go through and the training, and they emphasize that most of them will not survive. And as we see in the movies, most of them don't, and you know, how most of them are killed, and they really capitalize on that in the book, and you just appreciate how lethal Fel is. And the dogfighting in the art is really well done, and like they show them like strafing targets, and but it also explores the intrigue within the Empire itself, and he has Shane. Remember the character Izzard? The intelligence woman for the Empire. She has a key role in the story, this book as well. and they explore sort of her presence and how dangerous she is. This is smart stuff. This Murray, you probably didn't get your hands on this, I would assume, right?
I would like to. I did buy the first couple of arcs of Rogue Squadron back in the day, but I didn't get as far as number 25. I think you sold me, Chris. Like anything that fleshes out the Empire a bit, shows us the internal culture and more of its role in the galaxy. And just,
then I think you'll like this then, yeah. That's why I love
it. Would you say that this Baron Fell person has anything in common with DC's enemy Ace?
Yes, that's an excellent. I agree with that. I never thought of that. That's a great analogy. Especially as not so much in the beginning, he's more indoctrinated, but as the story progresses, he starts to become more thoughtful. Again, I think the story is also a reflection on how dangerous it is when you embrace a cause that will be thinking about what it really means and what are all the facets of it. In other words, you know, you should think critically. and
kind of message is that?
What's that?
I said, what kind of message is that?
I know I'm a man out of, I'm not in step with the times these days, of course, but I'm a teacher. I have to say these things. So, he's not like Enemy Ace from the very beginning is a far more thoughtful protagonist. I think Phil is more in that along those lines at the end. Now, again, because I don't want to ruin it. There's also something going on in his personal life that is also a massive reason why he's going to start to change his tune. As well, which there's a neat twist when it comes to that. So, and also, if you read subsequent issues, you find out who he's actually talking to, and that's very interesting as well.
Okay.
Shane, you're going to love this.
Right. Once again,
I'm ready to rate if you guys are.
Once again, Chris, good choice. Go ahead.
Thanks. Covers Tim Bradstreet, who, I mean, he's the Preacher cover guy, so I love his stuff. That's an A+. Story's an A+. Art, I'll give an A-. Paul, I'm very much in keeping with – I love your analogy to Beauty and the Beast. I really enjoy the art. There are moments where it has almost like a manga feel to it with some of the facial expressions as well. The space battles, I think, are the strongest part. And the whole package I'll give an A2.
As somebody who has not read all of the extra stuff for Star Wars, I'm very, very sporadic in a lot of that. I would say the cover is intriguing, and if it was something where I was walking through a comic book store and I was looking for something to read, this would catch my eye and quite possibly be something I would pick up just because, let me give this a shot. I'm going to say, for me, a solid B on the cover. Very good, but, not iconic in my mind. The interior art, I think it's all very well drawn. Even the stuff that, stylistically, I have some question about. So I'm going to say it's an A on the art, but for me personally, it probably drops down to a B just because of some stylistic issues. But that's just a personal as opposed to objective view. And I found the story to be very well done. I thought it pulled me along. It pulled me in. And again, it wasn't quite so heavy-handed where it very easily could have fallen into that trap. So I'm going to say an A on the story. And overall, for me, as somebody who's not totally immersed in the extra Star Wars stuff, I'm going to say it's a B+. Probably would be an A if I read all the extra stuff. I'm more just into the cinematic stuff than I am into the reading.
Bill?
I love the cover. I got no qualms with the cover. That's an A. I did want to point something else about the art. So in the opening page when he's being interviewed, he's portrayed very sinister. Like even his eyes look black.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it's all in shadow. And then when you get to the end of the book and you see him now, his eyes are white. Like in the last photo where he's looking – well, photo. The last picture where he's looking forward and you now see the white of his eyes – and you've gone through and gotten his whole backstory, and it's almost like he's come out of his shadow.
Great
and
point.
He's revealing himself to the person he's speaking to. So that kind of touch there offsets Yoda Emperor for me. So I will give the art I'll give the interior art like an A minus, but for story I give it an A plus because of all the there's so many characters in here and so many like Biggs was on the ship the Rand Ecliptic, and later in Rogue Squadron Biggs's son I believe or there's his cousin. There's another Darklighter that's in Rogue Squadron, and hell, there's even a genetically modified Gamorrean that becomes a pilot, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many. It's such the Rogue Squadron books are. There's so much in there. It's great. It's great. This is a overall an A plus.
Right. When you said about Yoda Emperor, I could see it when I looked at that picture, and all I thought in my head was, "What for the Emperor you are?"
Would that make him the Emperor?
Bill, you and Ian should do stand up together. Holy mackerel!
And that reminds me, next time we do this, we got to get Ian back in. Unfortunately, he was planning to be with us tonight, but. I believe he is either he's doing something for work or he's doing something for his personal life. I don't know why either is more important than this, but that happens.
He got show tickets, and when you get free tickets to something, you got to use them.
Yeah. He had free tickets to Back to the Bins. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Wait. These tickets are free?
No, you still have to keep
paying. You make me pay to come on
You have to
here.
Keep paying. But as always, it's always a pleasure to have you gentlemen on. And, as you're well aware, you have an open invitation anytime you want to come on. And I appreciate you carving out the time to do this with me, or with us, rather. Couldn't appreciate it more. Just by way of...
appreciate being asked to perform it.
By way of reference,
thank you very much.
As we record this, we're about a week out from hearing these gentlemen do their Wolverine spotlight episode on the Comic Timing podcast. And if you don't listen to that, I would strongly recommend it.
It was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun.
So thanks again, guys.
Couldn't have done it without my compatriots here, though. Everybody contributes. It's a great time.
Yeah, it always it always is.
Chris, I don't know if I mentioned this before when we were on a show or if we have been. I'm sporadic with being on, but many of your spotlight episodes I have listened to. You have been at work with me, my friend. In my ears while I'm, supposed to be paying attention to what I'm doing. And I'm like, no, that's not the way that happened. What is he talking about? Who are you talking to? Nothing. I'm fine. We're all fine here.
Anything that can help you get through work, I'm honored to participate in that.
Yes, many a quality hours spent doing spotlights. So, again, thank you guys. Thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next week. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.